A very good afternoon and welcome to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host of the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking each week, and often Christians in discussion as well about theological issues. That's what we're doing today on the programme. We're going to be debating hell and the book of Revelation. More on that in a moment's time as I introduce my guest. But if you're coming along, you're listening for the first time, perhaps you've discovered us on our podcast and you're not sure what Unbelievable's about, well, we host high quality debates between people on different points of view on certain philosophical issues, especially the existence of God and that kind of thing. We do that a lot here on the programme. If you want to find the full back catalogue, join the many, many people who subscribe to the podcast each week, then go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Why not rate us there as well, if you're listening via iTunes or some other way you can actually tell people about what you thought of the programme. And of course, if you go to our website, you can find links to lots of other resources, articles, features, blogs and so on, including of course this year's Unbelievable the Conference on DVD and audio CD, and there's also a digital download option available. We were talking about how to unleash your inner evangelist this year with a variety of brilliant speakers and thinkers from all over the world joining me for that day conference in London, along with over 750 people in the auditorium. So if you'd like to get hold of it, then just go again to the website and follow the links, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Later on today, straight after this show, between 4 and 5, Candy Statton, gospel singing legend, joins Moira to talk about her life, faith and amazing career. Next week on Unbelievable, we're going to finally do the debate that probably a lot of you have been waiting for. We don't do politics very often, but with what's been going on in the States, we feel we should do something along these lines. We're going to be asking, should Christians vote for Donald Trump? So look out for that at the same time next week. We'll also be hearing some of your feedback later on in today's programme to the last few weeks of programming. A fantastic email, actually, really interesting one on responding to Darren Brown, someone who claims they can show Darren Brown objective evidence of physical healing. And we'll also be hearing a little bit about what I did last weekend at the Rethinking Hell conference. Very interesting day spent with people, many of whom were Unbelievable listeners. So looking forward to telling you about that. Right now, time to get on with today's programme. You're unbelievable. Today on the show, we're asking, what does Revelation say about hell? Now, the book of Revelation is often the one Christians point to, both for their views on the end times and on the view that hell is a place of eternal conscious torment. Well, today we're debating whether that's true. Chris Date is the public face of Rethinking Hell. It's a website dedicated to putting the biblical case for conditional immortality. The idea that hell is a place of final destruction, not everlasting torment. You can find out more at rethinkinghell.com. And Chris is over for a special conference taking place here in the UK. And I should say we're recording this. At the time of recording, the conference has not taken place. But you will be hearing from me later on in the show because I am going along to the conference to be able to tell you all about it. But today on the programme, Robert Wiesner is also our guest. He's on via Skype from the US, where he's youth pastor at Grace Covenant Church in Cincinnati. He's actually finishing a master's in theology at Dallas Theological Seminary. Now, Robert today is going to be defending a traditional eternal conscious punishment view of hell from the book of Revelation. But we'll certainly be discussing in general the way we should approach the book of Revelation. So I'm looking forward to this as a show where you will get to learn a lot as well as hear an interesting discussion. So a very warm welcome to the show, both Chris and Robert. Welcome along.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's lovely to have you both on. Chris, not your first time here on Unbelievable.
I know, you must be really hurting for good guests.
Nonsense. I'm really glad you've come back. I'm really pleased to be involved with both the conference, but I also think what you've been doing with the website is really amazing in terms of the breadth of scholarship you're drawing together, the book that you've produced, and lots of things in this important area.
Well, thank you.
Last time you were on was a while ago, but with a well-known guest on the other side, Al Mohler.
That's right.
From Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. A lot of people, you know, said that they thought you basically really won the day on that one when it came to the debate on eternal conscious torment and annihilationism. Do you feel that show kind of helped to lift the general knowledge and understanding a bit of the debate?
Oh, I think in the eyes of some people it may have done that. I think that for many others, they probably they probably felt like he just didn't come in prepared, and so their their resolve in favor of the traditional view is probably even stronger than it was before. Boy, if I'd been the one to go in that debate, I would have done better. So I think the reactions are mixed.
I mean, what do you think is the value generally? You do a variety of things. There's a podcast, there's articles, there's the book, there's the conference. What's the value particularly of debating? Because you've done quite a few debates on this.
Well, honestly, for me, the single biggest reason I go into the debates is because I want to show fellow Christians how they can disagree with fellow Christians on important topics like this, but on topics that really ought not to be cause for division. Too often this topic generates more heat than light, and so when I can debate a fellow Christian and we can be loving and respectful and kind and charitable to one another, I think that's a win, even if nobody changes their mind on the topic.
Okay. Well, let's introduce Robert, who, as I say, is a youth pastor at Grace Covenant Church in Cincinnati, joining us online via Skype. Robert, welcome along to the program.
Oh, it's great to be here. And Chris, I'm really happy to be able to talk to you about this subject, too.
It's my pleasure and honor as well.
Robert, do you want to tell us a little bit about how you kind of got an interest in talking about and getting involved in this particular area of theology?
Sure. So I went to Dallas Christian College to do my bachelor's degree in biblical studies and biblical languages. And the very first course I took on was a New Testament survey course, and the professor introduced his views of this topic, which are similar to Chris's. He holds to conditional immortality, and it was the first time I had heard of a Bible-believing Christian, you know, advocating that view. I had always associated that with, you know, kind of the Jehovah's Witnesses or something, some pseudo-Christian cult or something like that. And so he raised some interesting points that challenged some assumptions that I had. And that kind of drove me to the books to nuance my view better, or maybe even change it, because I do think there are some cogent arguments that can be made for Chris's position. But I always found myself going back to the book of Revelation, where I think you have the key texts, because they're the ones that have the temporal language associated with the future punishment of the wicked. And so it's been a topic I've gone back and forth on. And I first heard Chris on your show a few years back, and he's talking to a UK pastor there, Steve Jeffrey, I believe was the name.
Yeah,
that's and right. they had a really great conversation there, and I think that's when I first reached out to Chris, and I've come back to the topic every so often just because I really love the Book of Revelation. I think it's the most beautiful literature we have in the Bible. And it's bizarre and intriguing, but imaginative, and it's just a really fun piece of literature to be studying. And it has a lot to say on this topic, and so I think it's really important for how somebody's going to nuance their views.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to us talking about the Book of Revelation, because I think in many ways it's often a rather closed book to many Christians. It's that strange book at the right at the end, where it deals in lots of interesting imagery, and we're never, you know, I'm not quite sure what to do with all of that, so I'm just going to kind of stick to the bits I do understand. That's certainly the way I think lots of Christians think about it. So I hope today's program, as well as obviously discussing this particular issue, is also helpful in terms of the way we can hopefully get more out of the Book of Revelation as a whole. So we're interested in your views today. Chris was actually on our Inspirational Breakfast show last week, and he was talking about this whole issue there and got some interesting calls, I think, pushback from some of the listeners on the Your Call section of the Inspirational Breakfast program. If you want to go to their website, or indeed go to the Unbeliever website, and we'll post the link there, you can listen back to Chris as well on that too. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I'll post the link there. Post the links, of course, to Rethinking Hell, and where you can find out more about Robert as well. And of course, you can find past shows, interact, leave comments, and subscribe to the Unbelievable podcast. And I never say this, and I was picked up by someone recently. If you are listening via iTunes, for instance, go and rate the show. Apparently that does good stuff for a podcast. Yeah, I've heard. So I should really get people doing that more. But why not let other people know about it in some way? Be great to do that. But again, all the links and more available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So today we're asking, what does Revelation say about hell? Often the book that Christians point to, both for views on the end times and the view that hell is a place of eternal conscious torment. But is that the case? Well, Chris Date says no. He changed his mind a number of years ago on hell and now believes in what's called conditional immortality or annihilationism, that hell is a place of final destruction, not everlasting torment. Well, can we find that in the book of Revelation? Robert Wiesner, pastor of Grace Covenant Church, a youth pastor, I should say, is going to be putting the other side, the traditional eternal conscious punishment view of hell from Revelation. But let's start with Revelation in general, gentlemen. Chris, where do you see Revelation as a book fitting into the genres of literature we find across the Bible?
Yeah, well, the book of Revelation is generally accepted to be in the genre of what's called apocalyptic or apocalyptic prophecy. This is really important because its nature is not as if a tape recording of the future was sent back in time and John watched it on a TV screen or something like that. This is a highly symbol-laden, vivid, perplexing dream that John received on the island of Patmos, just like Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the giant statue, you might recall, or Daniel's dream of the four beasts. And so when we come to this genre, we need to be very careful. No matter what doctrines that we're trying to draw from this book, we need to be extremely careful, arguably much more so than in any other genre of biblical literature, because in other genres, truth is conveyed in, by and large, plain, straightforward language intended to be taken very ordinarily.
Right.
Whereas here, we're dealing with a much more difficult to interpret literature.
What are some of the common pitfalls, Robert, that you see people making when it comes to the book of Revelation?
Yeah, I think Chris hit the point that we need to make, and that's that it's not a pre-recording of the future. I think people seek to interpret it in ways that make it almost irrelevant to the original audience who it was written to encourage. And so what I think interpreters need to do is begin by trying to understand what this bizarre imagery would have meant to those original readers who received this this book, how they would have interpreted it and understood all the symbols. If it doesn't make sense if our interpretation doesn't make sense for them, then it shouldn't be accepted for us today, because this is something that John Walton, who's a professor at Wheaton College, always says. You know, the Bible was written for us, but it wasn't written to us, and so we need to begin by trying to understand what John was trying to communicate to those original readers and hearers. And so Chris mentioned that we're dealing with the genre that came to be called apocalyptic, and that was a genre that was pretty widespread in Jewish circles and even outside of Jewish circles in John's day. And so we see a lot of this bizarre imagery in other books that are that predate the book of Revelation and that are also contemporary with and a little bit later than Revelation. And I think having that historical context really helps us to understand what John is saying with the symbols that he uses in Revelation. And one other point that I think Chris would definitely agree with me on is that John's primary source for his imagery is in the Old Testament. And that's going to come up when we talk about chapter 14 and what it says about the nature of future punishment. But we need to pay careful attention to the way John's using the Old Testament to derive his imagery. And so instead of going to, I would say the newspaper, but that's dated now, instead of going to your Fox News or CNN feed, you know, to see what's going on in current events. No, that's not what John's talking about. We need to go back to the first century and to the Old Testament and let John speak for himself in
so,
that way.
What do you make, Chris, of some branches of the church that do take some of the imagery and apply it to some kind of dispensational theology where you've got, you know, well, this dragon and woman riding it is some reference to, I don't know, either the EU or Donald Trump or something. You know, how far should we be taking those things and trying to see that these represent something in our day or that's going on?
Well, I mean, the biggest I see two problems with that kind of approach. Number one, it seems to me, I'm what's called a partial preterist, although that's language I don't like to use for that's another topic of another conversation. But I'm a partial preterist, and what I observe is that at the very beginning of the Book of Revelation and at the very end, John explains using a variety of Greek words that the bulk of his vision would come to pass in very soon to him. Mm. There is a very long period of time called called the millennium toward the end of Revelation. But everything, most of everything prior to it, I would think, would be fulfilled in the lifetime of John. That's when he said it would happen, is very soon. So that's the first problem. And the second problem is just that as soon as you start divorcing these symbols from their Old Testament context and you start trying to, as Robert said, look in the newspaper for fulfillment of them, you're completely removing yourself any ability to objectively interpret this imagery. You know, you're just sort of picking and choosing what might, in any given day, happen to sound like it might fulfill these descriptions. I really think that, as Robert said, we need to go back to how the Bible uses that imagery. Otherwise, I think we're just exercising speculation.
So you're very wary of anyone who proclaims such and such is being fulfilled in our day in the Book of Revelation, or even tries to make some prediction about when the end will come and that kind of thing.
That's very true. The only thing that I see in Revelation that might be being fulfilled in our day is what the imagery there describes as the release of Satan. It says that he was bound, I think, in the first century so that he would not be able to deceive the goyim, the Gentiles, the nations. And for nearly 2,000 years, we have in fact seen that Gentiles are the predominant part of the church. But we're seeing a rapid, I think, growth of Christianity among Jewish populations. And as a result, and meanwhile, I'm seeing Gentiles increasingly abandoning the faith. Mm. So I think that might be happening in our day. But other than that, as you say, I'm very wary.
Okay. How much are we at liberty, Robert, to kind of use Revelation in these kinds of ways to talk about what's happening today? Do you think there's any merit in using it to talk about the return of Jesus and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I definitely think it speaks in multiple places, actually, about the return of Jesus. I don't know Chris's view completely, but most interpreters who would identify with a partial preterist view, which I would as well, even though we recognize that its primary significance is in the first century, we also believe that it gives us some information about the future. Again, especially in chapter 19, you see Jesus return to slay God's enemies, and then there's eventually a resurrection and a judgment. I don't think Chris believes that that's happened already. I certainly don't. And so there are some future elements to it. And what else I would want to say is, beyond that, even the imagery that we have that I think, again, was primarily for that first century audience, I do believe it gives us sort of a typological picture of what the Christian experience is going to be like, what should be normative for the church in all ages. And so a British scholar who's deceased now, who taught at Oxford, George Caird, he said this. He said that John's coming crisis was simply the persecution of the church, and that all the varied imagery of the book has no other purpose than this: to disclose to the prospective martyrs the real nature of their suffering and its place in God's eternal purposes. And so I think it's that message that it keeps Revelation being relevant to the church in all ages, especially if you go to places where society is still hostile to Christianity. And a few years back, we had Christians being killed in Iraq by being beheaded. Well, that's the exact image that the Book of Revelation uses of people being beheaded for their faith in Jesus. And that the call of Revelation is to endure, be faithful, even unto death. And so I think it gives us that picture of what the church age is supposed to be like, even though we want to ground that in first century. Yeah.
So given that a lot of the imagery is going to be directly relevant to the scenario John was speaking into, how are we then to grapple with these quite strange to us images that come up, about the bowls and the lampstands and scrolls being eaten and all this sort of stuff? Is there a way from within the text to say, well, this is what that means? Or do we have to kind of say, well, it might mean this in his day and so on? Do you have any clues for that? Chris?
Well, I mean, I think that we have two big clues, generally speaking. One is, as Robert has already mentioned, the use of that symbolism in the Old Testament. Some interpreters have said that Revelation, more than any other book in the New Testament, is deeply saturated by allusions to the Old Testament. Richard Bauckham has said that the meaning of the symbolism in the Old Testament is absolutely critical to understanding Revelation. And so that's number one. Number two, there are times in the book of Revelation and in other places in Scripture where this kind of highly symbolic apocalyptic imagery is interpreted for us. We can go back to, for example, when Joseph is in prison and he interprets the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker. He tells them that the three branches in one of their dreams are 3 days and that the baskets on the other one's head in his dream is 3 days. He tells Pharaoh that the 7 cows that come up out of the river are 7 years. Mm. And Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar that the statue has certain meanings. So we see this in Revelation as well. This 7-headed 10-horned beast, an angel interprets it for John saying the 7 heads are 7 kings, you know, and there are other places as well. So if we keep those two clues in mind, number one, what did this symbolism mean in the Old Testament from which Revelation is drawing? And number two, how do biblical figures interpret that imagery for us? And we'll talk about this later. Mm. I think if we follow those two things, we'll come away with an understanding of what it says.
Yeah. To what extent are we allowed to go down the route then of taking it out of its original context, would you kind of divide Revelation up in any way between stuff that's definitely John's time and stuff that is stuff that's kind of relevant for us?
I would say that anything prior to the millennium, we should be very wary to apply to our modern day. It's possible that it may have direct application. It certainly could have sort of implicit application in the sense that its fulfillment in the first century and the encouragement that John was trying to give his readers can have an applied, you know, encouragement to us today. But I think we still need to be really careful. It's what happens toward the end and after the millennium that I think we can have confidence is awaiting fulfillment in our future. How it's to be fulfilled, I think we need to figure out using those clues I just mentioned.
Well, let's talk a little bit about maybe areas of disagreement between you both, because at this point, I think you're both broadly in agreement about the best ways of treating Revelation, making sure we're aware of the Old Testament imagery and so on. But you do come to different conclusions when it comes to what it has to say about hell. And Revelation is probably pretty, it's pretty colourful when it comes to its descriptions of hell and the afterlife.
Yes.
So let's maybe get a summary of both your views on this. Robert, do you want to start us off with a summary of the, you know, what has historically been the dominant view, eternal torment or eternal conscious punishment, and how that figures as far as you can see in Revelation?
Sure. A lot of times my view gets labeled, you know, the traditional view, and I'm okay with that because I do respect the tradition, but I prefer the label eternal conscious punishment. Because I don't believe the view simply because I've inherited it in the tradition. I respect the tradition, but I believe the view because I'm convinced that that's what the Bible leads us to. And so I want to define it in those terms. And that language of eternal punishment or eternal torment comes right out of the book of Revelation in texts like chapter 14, 9 through 11, and the latter part of chapter 20. And
hear those read out? Because I think that would be really helpful for framing this as well.
Sure, you'd like me to read them?
Well, I think Chris has them to hand.
Okay.
Do you, Chris?
Yeah, sure.
Do you want to read us? Because I think the ones we're talking about here, Revelation 14, verses 9 to 11, and Revelation 20, verses 10 to 15. And this will help to frame it for the audience.
Sure. So in the first passage you mentioned, this is John describing what he saw. He said, "Another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, these worshippers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of his name.'" And then the other passage I think that Robert and I both think is really crucial to this discussion is Revelation 20, 10 to 15. I won't read the entirety of these verses, but I'll read the relevant portions. John, again, describing what he saw in his dream, says the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. And then he goes on to see Death and Hades give up their dead, and the dead are judged according to what is written in the books, and then the dead are thrown into the lake of fire, those dead who aren't covered by the blood of the Lamb, and then Death and Hades are thrown into the fire as well. So these are the two passages that we're really talking
these
about.
These are the key passages that people tend to be thinking of. So coming back to you, Robert, well, firstly, what do you do with the actual kind of sulfur, fire, lake of fire type of imagery itself? Because a lot of people, I think, do have that in their mind, you know, a place of fire and sulfur when it comes to hell. Is that relevant to as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, the relevance is, I think, that John is using this kind of imagery to get the audience to paint a picture in their minds of the worst imaginable suffering. One scholar, David De Silva, has done a lot of work on the way rhetoric works in the Book of Revelation. And he talks about the concept of relative expediency. And what John is challenging his audience to do is to think about whether or not it's worth trying to save their lives and their day by capitulating to the demands of the culture to participate in emperor worship and thereby deny Jesus so that they wouldn't be killed in this life, or remain faithful to Jesus and at the cost of their lives. Well, at the end of the day, it's more expedient for them to actually obey Jesus, even if they're going to die for it, because what awaits them is the most horrific fate the human mind can basically imagine, and that's this imagery of eternal torment by fire. Now, I do think that it would probably be taking the language to a place John didn't intend by saying that it's a literal fire, literal burning sulfur. A lot of people have noticed the kind of mixed metaphors that you can find in the Bible. You've got this language of outer darkness in Jesus, and then you've got this lake of fire, which, you know, those two don't seem to go quite well together. I think that they're probably all intended to be taken metaphorically, especially that's what we should expect in an apocalypse like what we have here in Revelation. So John's purpose then in painting this picture of ceaseless, relentless, restless torment by fire and sulfur forever and ever is his way of showing them the expediency of enduring persecution in this age and faithfulness to Christ versus compromising in order to, you know, save their neck now, but then experiencing a worse fate, far worse fate in the future. So it's all about the comparison of you know, the relative expediency there.
Okay, well, look, we'll take a quick break and we'll come back to the case for precisely why you think he's also, though, making the case for this being an ongoing eternal thing.
Yes.
And we'll see what Chris has to say in response to that. So we're doing a theological debate on Unbelievable this afternoon here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Revelation, often the book Christians use to talk about the end times and hell. But what does it really say about hell? Today, Chris Date of Rethinking Hell and Robert Wiesner are debating that, and we'll be back with both of them in a moment's time. See you then. 40 years ago, four teenagers met in a kitchen in Dublin and decided to form a band. Since then, U2 have conquered the rock world and never been afraid to sing about God while doing so. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we chart their four-decade spiritual journey and the impact they've had on the global church. Plus, we talk to Eric Metaxas on why he's backing Trump. We explore the rise of the true crime documentary and find new ways to pray. All that plus much more. Make sure you pick up a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. We've got a theological discussion for you today on hell, something we've covered in a variety of ways, often within the kind of realm of what we're talking about today, the eternal conscious torment view, perhaps sometimes called the traditional view, versus annihilationism or conditional immortality. Chris Date returns to the show today. He's the public face of Rethinking Hell. But today, the subject is what Revelation, the book of Revelation, says about hell. And he's engaging in a dialogue today with Robert Wiesner, who's a pastor out in Grace Covenant Church, Cincinnati, and he's defending, Robert's defending the, if you like, eternal conscious punishment view of hell. Says that does seem to be what Revelation tells us, and Chris is going to be pushing back on that today. If you're interested in these kinds of discussions, again, go to the website. You can find loads more theological debates here on Unbelievable, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You won't want to miss our debate coming up in a couple of weeks' time between N.T. Wright and Tom Schreiner on the cross, the atonement. That's going to be a really interesting one. So if you like this, you may well like that as well. So look out for that on your podcast feed on the radio in due course. Don't forget, we'll get some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. Do email in with your thoughts about today's programme, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, you can leave your comments underneath today's show. Find it on Facebook and Twitter and leave me your comments that way. @unbelievablejb. facebook.com/unbelievablejb. That's the Twitter and Facebook ways of getting in touch. I look forward to hearing from you. All the links as well as my guests available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So we were just at the end of that section, Robert, hearing why for you it is probably the right thing to take those images of fire and self and so on as metaphorical. John trying to impress upon his first readers that denying Christ it seals a fate that's much worse than suffering for him in this life, if you like. And that was the kind of the most sort of radical sort of language he could come up with. I guess the point being, by saying it, oh, it's not really fire and sulfur, we wouldn't want people to go, I think, oh, well, it's not very bad. It's a sobering thing, whatever it is. It's something. But why particularly then would it be an everlasting thing? What's your view on the temporal nature of this suffering?
Yeah, sure. Well, you get a few clues in the text. And I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of conditionalists, people who hold Chris's view, are willing to admit that. And Chris himself, in a conversation he and I had about this, he admits it as well, that this is definitely a picture, at least, of eternal conscious torment. And so Ralph Bowles, who wrote an essay that's included in one of the books that Chris edited, I think it was Rethinking Hell, he said, the traditional interpretation offers what seems to be the obvious meaning of the text, a depiction of endless tormenting punishment by God. And I think that's exactly what the image we see here is. And some of the clues, some scholars have done some word studies on the verb that's translated torment there. And in all literature surveyed, this is the idea of conscious torment. It's not language of killing, but it's language of experiencing conscious suffering. It can be through different means. And then you get the temporal, the two temporal phrases here, where you have no rest day or night, and then before that you have the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. And so John seems to be repeating that, making that part emphatic, that this is unending, ceaseless, restless punishment. What again, metaphorically through fire and sulfur, but nevertheless. Unending. And what I think is really crucial is to compare this language to what we get elsewhere. So in chapter 9, we get this bizarre image of these locusts being let out of the bottomless pit. And it says that they're given the authority to torment people, but not to kill them. And the people are going to be in such agony that they'll want to die, but it says death is going to flee them. They won't be allowed to die. And then you also have killing and consumption language used in chapter 19 and chapter 20, which is different from this eternal torment language. And so I think we have to let John's use of different metaphors play against each other in the way he seems to want us to. And when we do that, this final fate of the wicked seems to be uniformly presented in terms of their eternal conscious experience of suffering as God's righteous punishment for their rejection of him.
Okay. I think you've very well spelt that out and making the case for this being an eternal thing. Okay, Chris, so where do you go then with these images and pictures and what they have to say about the duration of this punishment?
Sure. Robert is right. I'm the first to admit that John sees in this dream that he has eternal torment, although there is some difficulty with understanding how that would work since John isn't literally seeing the image to this day. So he didn't actually see eternal torment, but whatever he saw in his imagery meant him or caused him to describe it as something that would go on forever in the dream. I do disagree a little bit with Robert, in that I don't think that John is coming up with this imagery and describing it for his audience in some way to impress upon them some meaning. I think he's describing what was given to him, the imagery he saw as a seer, as a revelator, or revelator. Mm-hmm. So there's that difference. And then I also don't think that he's really coming up with the imagery to come up with some sort of meaning about his readers being scared of the worst fate imaginable. I think rather that we should understand the imagery as it is used in the Old Testament once it came. But let's say for a moment that I agreed with, and I am getting to answer your question in a moment.
That's fine.
The other thing is, though, even if I were to agree with Robert said that John is trying to get his readers to understand that the consequences are the worst fate imaginable, what the worst fate imaginable is a matter of debate. First, the Church Father Augustine, for example, said that if the lost had the choice between an eternal life in torment or annihilation, they would all much prefer life in torment forever. First century Plutarch, historian Plutarch, said that the Greeks would have much preferred life forever in torment to annihilation. When I was a kid and I was an atheist, before I was a believer, I didn't think there was an afterlife, and when I thought of ceasing to be altogether, the thought absolutely terrified me. Now, I understand that not everybody's going to share Augustine's or Plutarch's or my understanding of what the worst fate imaginable is, but the point is that if that's what we understand John to be doing, that doesn't get us anywhere in this debate. It could go either way.
Because that's a somewhat subjective
issue
as to which of those two fates is the worst imaginable.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So with those caveats out of the way, my understanding as a conditionalist who believes in conditional immortality is that life is God's provisional gift to all, and that it's either going to be granted to the saved forever in the form of immortality, or it'll be revoked from the lost forever in the punishment of final death. And thus, in our view, immortality is conditioned upon salvation. Only the saved will live forever. The lost will die forever. Now, with that in mind, when I come to these passages, using those clues we talked about earlier, what the imagery meant in the Old Testament and how it's interpreted by the book of Revelation itself, I think we have very good reason to think it describes exactly that final death that I just mentioned. So, for example, we read Revelation 14 a moment ago, and we read about drinking God's wrath and fire and sulfur and smoke rising forever. All three of these images are used in the Old Testament to describe final destruction. Smoke rises forever from the destroyed city of Edom, where it says that it will burn day and night. There's that day and night language as well. Abraham sees smoke rising from the plains of Sodom and Gomorrah after fire and sulfur rained down on it and killed their inhabitants.
The point is the inhabitants are dead.
The inhabitants...
They're not still being burnt and suffering in that way.
Well, they may in the afterlife in Hades, but the imagery is all coming from destruction language.
Yeah.
And all of this is being repurposed here in this chapter to teach something. And in fact, we see those three same symbols used elsewhere in Revelation, that the mystery, the harlot, who's got Mystery Babylon written on her forehead. She's tormented in fire. Smoke rises from her forever. And she drinks the cup of God's wrath. But the angel tells us that the city represented by that harlot will be destroyed, will be no more. So when we look at how this symbolism is used elsewhere, both in Revelation and in the Old Testament, I see absolutely no reason to take it in the way that Robert does. Instead, I see every reason to take John's vision as communicating that the lost will be finally destroyed.
Okay, Robert, so as far as Chris can see, where if John is using Old Testament imagery, we have to look at the Old Testament imagery. That seems to suggest some kind of destruction rather than an ongoing state of torment. What's your take on that?
Well, I made the point earlier that we need to not just look at the Old Testament passages that he quotes, but what he actually does with them. And when we do that, we see that John has taken over the image of Edom's destruction in Isaiah 34, which goes back to the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah, which became a type in Jewish literature for the fate of the ungodly, because Sodom and Gomorrah was seen as an especially wicked city. And so their fate is the fate that the worst of sinners were to experience. And John uses that imagery in a couple different ways. He does use it later on in chapters 18 and 19 to describe the fate of the great whore and of the Babylon, you know, which I take as an image of Rome. I think Chris might disagree with me a little bit there. But if we pay careful attention to John's use of Isaiah 34 in this text, we'll see that he's made some really important changes that show that he's clearly applying this to individuals who have a different fate awaiting them than a city or a political world power. So we're told in chapter 20, which we'll get to eventually, that there's going to be a universal resurrection. So even though everybody dies, they're going to be resurrected to face judgment. Well, that's not true of the cities that we see experiencing this destruction. And John takes what Isaiah has as an image of a fire that will never be extinguished in Isaiah 34. And he turns that and he says, not that the fire will never be extinguished, but they, those who experience this fire, will have no rest day or night forever and ever. So he takes a third person singular in reference to the fire, and he changes it to a third person plural in reference to these worshipers of the beast and what their fate is. And that's different, again, from what he says in Revelation 18:8 and 19:3 of this city. So I agree that John can use this imagery for the destruction of a city, but he's applying that same typological image to the fate of these worshipers of the beast. And there's also some scholarly matters of the way biblical typology works that maybe we can get into after Chris responds to that.
Yeah, do you want to respond, Chris?
Sure. I mean, I agree with Robert that that John's the source of John's vision. I want to be clear here. I don't think it's John doing anything. It's the source of John's vision is taking the imagery from Isaiah that describes the corporate judgment of a people, and he's taking it in one place in Revelation 18 and 19 to describe the final the judgment the destruction of a city, and elsewhere in Revelation here in 14 he's using it to talk about the judgment of individuals. What I don't think follows, therefore, is that imagery that is intended to communicate total destruction and extinction in one context can be thought to mean immortal life forever in misery. That's something that doesn't follow. Just the fact that they are seen by John tormented forever in Revelation 14 doesn't mean that he intends for that imagery to mean something completely an opposite, completely different and opposite to what it meant when it came to the corporate judgments. Because he uses the same kind of thing in to describe the torment of the harlot in Revelation 19. This heavenly chorus in John's vision cries out, "Hallelujah, smoke rises from her forever." And this is from the torment that she'd experienced the chapter before. So in both cases, we have symbols in the imagery, tormented and smoke rising forever. I don't see what basis there is for saying that it means complete destruction and extinction in one case, but actually means immortal life forever and torment in the other. That doesn't seem to follow to me.
Do you want to respond quickly, Robert?
Yeah, sure. Well, again, I made the point that in chapter 20, these worshipers of the beast are among all of humanity that is resurrected. And this is a point that really needs to be made on theological grounds. Advocates of my view do not believe in, you know, the innate immortality of the soul, therefore eternal conscious torment follows. But we believe in the universal resurrection, that God is actually going to be raising people from the dead. I know Chris agrees with that view as well, in as far as the resurrection is concerned. I'm not trying to say he doesn't. The difference is these images of the city, you know, the great whore Babylon, are not going to experience that resurrection unless we want to try to and I'm open to this, understand those as kind of metonymies that refer to the people as well, which is a possibility. they have a different fate. The great whore is not going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ and be judged by what was written in the Lamb's Book of Life after having been resurrected. And so the patterns are different, and this imagery that John is using is sufficiently malleable, it's moldable, and so that he can employ it in different ways. And he's not bound to a cookie cutter use of this imagery, and that's the way typology actually works throughout the biblical literature. And as well, I'd say that there are other contemporaries of John who are writing apocalyptic literature, such as in the book of Jubilees 36, verses 9 to 11, that uses the language of Sodom and Gomorrah and Isaiah 34 in very similar ways to John, but more emphatically stressing the fact that they're going to be experiencing wrath and torment and indignation and plagues and sickness forever and ever without ceasing. And so this is a way that Jewish people in John's day use this imagery of Sodom and Gomorrah. He's right at home with his contemporary Jewish authors in this.
Yeah, I'd be interested in your response to whether it's valid to look at other non-biblical writings of the time and say, well, this was generally the way people conceived of it.
Right, yes. I will answer that. Well, I want to make clear, I don't think that the fact that the lost are resurrected automatically follows that their final fate is completely the opposite of what the fate of these cities were. Resurrection can be followed by final death and destruction. Mm. I think that's clearly what the imagery teaches. But that aside, for the most part, I agree with what Robert has said. I just think we need to take much more care when we look at what the contemporaneous literature in John's day meant. For example, in David Instone Brewer's chapter of our second book, he quotes Qumran's community rule as saying, "The judgment of all who walk in such ways will be multiple afflictions at the hand of the angels of perdition, everlasting damnation in the wrath of God's furious vengeance, never-ending terror and reproach for all eternity." And at this point, it sounds an awful lot like the kind, right? Yeah. But listen to what the community rule goes on to say. "With a shameful extinction in the fire of hell's outer darkness, their utter destruction with neither remnant nor rescue." So when we look at these texts, not even they are clear in meaning.
So what you're saying is the things that we initially often take as being speaking of some eternal conscious state can often be made to sound like that, but they still have in mind a destruction. It's just that the effects are eternal.
Well, I would say that the imagery depicts some sort of ongoing fiery vengeance, but the meaning of it often has to do with destruction. And also, I'm not necessarily saying this is what all Jews of John's day believed. Scholars like David Instone Brewer and E. Earl Ellis and many others will tell you that the Jewish literature from that day was varied in how it understood the afterlife. I would actually argue that the predominance of that literature teaches my view, but there was certainly eternal torment represented there as well. I don't think we're going to come to any conclusions based on it.
Yeah, Revelation, you said, I think, Robert, that for you, that's the clincher for you when it comes to supporting the eternal conscious torment view. Do you feel that it's a bit more kind of in the balance as far as the rest of the texts that are often used in hell, as far as Jesus' teaching on it and others, as to whether it would come down on conditional immortality or eternal conscious torment?
Yeah, this is one thing that I'm willing to admit that some of the people on my team would not like that I want to admit, and that's that if I didn't have the book of Revelation, I think Jesus, what we get in his teachings, leans in my favor, but I can understand and appreciate the conditionalist interpretations of those texts, and the same thing with the Old Testament. And then Paul almost exclusively uses simply death and destruction language. And so what I've told, and I think I told Chris this, what I've told others is that if it weren't for the book of Revelation, it would kind of be a coin flip for me. I could see myself being convinced of either position, but I think Revelation needs to be given some cautious priority because it alone has this really explicit temporal language. And so if we're asking the question, how long will the wicked suffer the fires of hell, so to speak, then we need to go to texts that are actually answering that question. I think those texts are in the book of Revelation.
Yeah, so, I mean, I hear what Robert's saying, and I want to say how much I respect and admire his willingness to go that far when it comes to the other literature in the Bible. Unfortunately, I think most traditionalists aren't willing to do that. I think where he and I would depart from one another are on that point are twofold. First of all, I actually think that the rest of the biblical language is very clear in favor of my view. I know he would disagree, but that's my position. And secondly, I think that Revelation is actually the book that we should not view, you know, interpret the rest of the Bible through.
That shouldn't be our primary.
No, it's the exact opposite source, because of its nature, because of how perplexing and difficult to interpret it is. I think that we ought to be interpreting it in light of the rest of the Bible. But anyway, those are just two areas that I would disagree with him on that point.
We haven't done much about Revelation 20, 10 to 15. So do you want to just share your thoughts on that particular passage?
Yeah, again, I fully admit that in the imagery, John sees the devil, the beast, and the false prophet tormented forever. Death and Hades, after being emptied of their dead, are thrown in along with the dead that come out of them. And if we're to treat the imagery consistent, we ought to expect those things to be, and those people to be tormented forever in the imagery as well. But the question is, what does that mean? And this is where that other clue that I pointed to earlier comes into play, this idea of biblical authors interpreting their own imagery. Because as I cited a number of examples in the Old Testament where the person says that the thing in the imagery means this in reality. Well, we see the same thing here in John 20, 14 and John 21, 8. We see John and God respectively saying the lake of fire is the second death. Now, what's important to understand is that this way of interpreting, this tradition of interpreting imagery throughout the Bible is one in which they say that the thing I see in the imagery means this thing in reality.
Right.
And what does John see? He sees a lake of fire and he sees torment taking place in it. But what is he told and what does he say this imagery means? And he says it means the second death. So what we have to do is we have to understand what the second death would have meant to John's readers to inform us as to how we understand the imagery. And I would argue that there's only two possible ways to understand it. One is to just to understand it as plain, straightforward language in the way that Joseph said the branches are 3 days or told Pharaoh that the seven cows are 7 years. Second death means literally dying a second time. And of course, that's my view, and it's the opposite of the traditional view. The other alternative is to look at how the second death as an idiom, as an expression, might have been used by John's readers. And there again, what we find is that in the contemporaneous literature, the second death universally or almost universally meant either exclusion from the life to come altogether or dying again after being resurrected. Yeah. So either way, the second death tells us that the imagery means final destruction.
This kind of extinction idea. Right. Yeah, okay. Just a couple of minutes before we have to get to the end of this section, Robert, for any comeback on that, this view that, okay, what is the imagery say? What do they say it means? It means the second death. Well, as far as Chris is concerned, that means a final end. So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think the understanding the second death is probably the most important difference that Chris and I have. I actually disagree with what he said about what the contemporaneous literature points us to. There's actually a lot more on this than some conditionalists in the literature that I've read will acknowledge. And a lot of them, and I'm not using this as a dig against Chris or anybody else, but a lot of them are dependent on secondary literature instead of actually going through and citing the sources where this language of second death is used. So when you actually do that and you actually look up these references, you'll see in some really important texts, such as the Targum Isaiah, which I think John is possibly even dependent on when he writes this section. It uses the language of second death in explicitly in terms of eternal conscious punishment. As well, you get language of two deaths described in a Jewish author roughly contemporary with John named Philo, where I don't think anybody would disagree that he believes in eternal conscious torment. He uses his language. He doesn't use the phrase the second death, but he talks about one kind of death and another kind of death. He talks about two deaths and the second one being a state of unending, ceaseless punishment. And so I think based on the way John uses the language, coupling it with this image of resurrection, as well as using the language of eternal torment, as opposed to what he used in chapter 19 of beasts feasting on the flesh Christ's vanquished foes and of others being killed by the sword. And then earlier in chapter 20, I believe it's verse 9, where fire comes down from heaven and consumes the humans who are seeking to attack God's people. That's a different image from this language of being tormented forever and ever, which is called the second death. And so I think I disagree with I think Chris might be overlooking some of the different images that John uses. And as well, I don't know if he's taking into account all that the contemporary literature has to say about the second death.
Just a very quick response, yeah, sure. Chris, and we'll go to our break.
I'm the first to admit that I'm no scholar of the contemporaneous Jewish literature. David Enstone Brewer is. He's the one that actually can read what those original documents said, and what he'll say the same thing I did, which is that the second death was used even in the Targum, I think, that Robert is referring to, probably to refer to final death rather than immortal life forever in torment. In fact, one of the Targums that is often used as the one example of second death not meaning what I've said it means, it actually says that the torment is not eternal. It says the torment will happen until, and then it says something like the saved are willing to forgive them or something like that. So I don't think the case is nearly as strong in his favor.
Anyway, both of you, I think, have made a great case for both your sides. So I wonder what you think about this. Again, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Going to be coming back for some final thoughts from both my guests about really where you go from here, what this means in practice, you know, what difference does this make to us if it is one or the other in Revelation, and how we can agree to disagree well on these kinds of issues. We'll be back for the final part of this discussion on the other side of a short break as we continue to ask, what does Revelation say about hell?
In July 2016, Unbelievable the Conference took place in London, a day for any Christian who struggles to share their faith with others.
I'm Justin Brierley, and I hosted a fantastic day of inspirational sessions with J. John, Gary Habermas, Beth Grove, and many others.
Now you've got the chance to watch and listen to over 12 hours of this empowering conference,
featuring evangelism, apologetics, and the resurrection.
Get your DVD at premier.org.uk/shop and become a confident evangelist today.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. And so many good shows coming up over October and November. We've got a couple of editions of the programme with N.T. Wright coming up. We've got Tim Keller going to be on the programme talking about his new book, Making Sense of God. And of course, next week, we're going to be having that debate on Donald Trump when I'm going to be joined by John Smirak, defending Donald Trump as the choice for American voters this year. And Christina Rees, who was former chair of Women in the Church. She's American now, living in the UK with dual nationality, going to be making the case against Trump, especially in light of recent revelations regarding inappropriate sexual comments and behaviour and so on. So I'm sure lots of people want to listen out for that one. We'll also hear some interviews that took place between Eric Metaxas and Tony Campolo, who have been sharing with us here their thoughts on the upcoming election. And speaking of which, Premier Christianity magazine, with whom Faith Explored is brought to you every week here on Premier Christian Radio, of which Unbelievable is a part. Well, we're going to be covering that in a big way in our November edition, and I'll be able to tell you all about that on next week's programme. But it's not too late to ask for a free sample copy of the October edition of the magazine. You can find a brilliant article on 40 years of U2 and their faith-fueled songs, and that's our cover feature. But loads of other interesting interviews, including that one with Eric Metaxas, some fantastic features, reviews, cultural analysis, and so on. So do go and ask for a free sample copy if you have never done that before. premierchristianity.com/free sample. As ever, you can listen back to today's programme on our website to find links to the podcast, leave comments and everything else underneath the latest show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Once we've concluded our discussion between Chris and Rob today, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme, and I'll be updating you on what did happen at last week's Rethinking Hell conference as well.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, as we conclude today's show, it's been a real pleasure to be joined in studio by Chris Date of Rethinking Hell. If you want to explore any of the issues we've been talking about on the show today, that is a treasure trove of articles, podcasts. You can get a book. There's the Rethinking Hell conferences. And I'm going to tell you how the most recent one in the UK went a little bit later on today's programme. Today on the programme, Chris has been in conversation with Robert Wiesner. He's pastor at Grace Covenant Church in Cincinnati. I'll make sure there are links to both my guests from the webpage today at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We've been asking, what does Revelation say about hell? And it's been a really good-natured discussion, even though my guests both disagree on the nature and duration of hell, both throughout the Bible, but specifically the way Revelation talks about it. I think it's modelled the fact that you can both sincerely disagree with each other, but also do it in a very graceful way, guys. So I want to thank you for that. Robert, that's not always the way when it comes to theological debates, yeah. Is it? So what you know, in that way, what can we learn about when we do disagree with each other on these things?
Yeah, sure. Not every doctrine is as clear as every other doctrine. Chris is a smart, sharp guy. He's been studying this topic for a long time, and he makes some really good arguments. I think that at the end of the day, I'm not convinced by them, but he's not compromising the way, say, a universalist does, the idea that there's a future judgment that awaits. And so he's proclaiming that there is real consequence for our failure to follow the lordship of Christ in this age. I don't agree with him that death, in the way he understands it, the second death, is a worse fate than eternal conscious torment. But nevertheless, I don't want to experience that either. And I think we still get that effect across that there is a horrific fate that awaits those who don't love and trust Jesus Christ as Lord. And so I think we're both going to be sharing our views in order to see people converted and to see Christians encouraged to endure persecution and just the way John intends us to. And so I'm thankful for Chris's friendship and his example in this. And I hope that Christians will think critically about the discussions that we've had and listen closely to what Chris had to say, listen closely to what I had to say, and go to the sources and study it for themselves and come away with their own conclusions.
I'm sure you agree with that, Chris. Mm. But another question that occurs to me, very often we do really interesting theological debates on Unbelievable. And I sometimes wonder, though, whether people end up thinking, but what was the point of that? Mm. How does this make a difference to my life right now? So what difference would it make whether Revelation is eternal conscious torment or is actually talking about a final end?
Well, that's a good question. I'm a bit of an enigma in the conditionalist community in that I don't think that the eternal conscious torment view is some sort of a barrier to evangelism or something like that. But it is. I am, as a Calvinist, I do think that the Holy Spirit who changes hearts is going to honor a gospel presentation that reflects the truth of the word that he inspired. And as such, I think it's at least possible that if my view is the correct understanding of the book of Revelation and the rest of Scripture, the gospel presentation will have a greater impact on the unbelieving world if it reflects a conditionalist perspective rather than a traditionalist one. I don't know. I think that's possible. It is certainly true that numerous atheists, including very high prominent, high profile ones, attribute the doctrine of eternal torment to their disbelief. So that's one thing. But the real critical thing is, or the two quick things. One is, I think that what we've gone over in terms of the nature of the genre of Revelation is really critical. I think people need to stop playing newspaper eschatology. but secondly, I really appreciate what Robert said, and I hope that listeners will realize that there are different possible ways to understand this imagery, and if you understand it in the way that I do, it doesn't make you a heretic worthy of damning to hell. I'm just as much interested in taking the word seriously as Robert is. I just come to different conclusions.
Sure. Robert, what for you would be the practical outcome of these kinds of discussions?
Well, I would like to say is something that I've heard others say is that you won't go to hell for believing Chris's view, but you might catch hell for it. When I first heard Chris's view, coming from a conservative evangelical background, I was taken aback and I wondered, does this compromise the gospel? And I don't believe that it does. I agree with him that If one is true, then we need to proclaim it, and that it may have some impact on our effectiveness in evangelism or in our ministry as pastors, whatever that may be. Chris still holds a view that I think holds up God's justice and his righteousness and the absolute complete sufficiency of the work of Jesus. And I'm happy to count him as a brother. I think it's important that we aren't afraid to interpret Revelation and get good theology out of it. It is apocalyptic. It is tricky. And so we need to exercise a lot of caution. But it's the apocalyptic text of the Old Testament that Jesus and the apostles derived their view of the resurrection from. That's in texts like Isaiah 26 and Daniel 12 and Ezekiel 37, passages like that. N.T. Wright's got a good section in his Resurrection of the Son of God to kind of show that. So the earliest Christians lived in a world where apocalyptic was around them, and that's a different world than the world we live in. But I think we need to venture into that world in order to understand early Christianity and our heritage in that faith. And so I hope that people will be encouraged to study Revelation, but exercise the care and caution that Chris is expressing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you both for being on the show today.
It's been my pleasure. Robert, it's always great to talk to you.
Great to have you both.
To talk to you too, man.
Yeah, thank you so much. Again, details of both my guests from today's website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find a number of other shows that Chris and others have contributed to on things like annihilationism, eternal conscious torment, also universalism, something that's been debated a number of times as well. So why not go and check out the back catalogue as well? But for the moment, thank you both for being on the show, and look forward to seeing you at some point in the future. Chris, I'm sure it's not the last time we'll see you here in the UK.
Like 2 days away, right? I'll see you next time.
And thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch, I'll be giving the ways to do that in just a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Look forward to hearing from you about today's show. Do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you can send your thoughts in via Twitter and Facebook as well at UnbelievableJB. To follow me on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. If you want to follow the show on Facebook, there is of course the Unbelievable group as well. It's a closed group, but you can ask to join it if you want, and every so often I add new people to the group who have requested that. That's if you want to get into some of those full-on debates that go on there between atheist Christians and people of other worldviews. But if you just want to follow the show and see what I post about the stuff we're doing and interesting articles and so on a regular basis, just look for Unbelievable, the Facebook page. Now, events coming up. We've got something special happening on Monday, the 14th of November. I'm going to be part of a panel of Christians and humanists in dialogue asking, can we agree to disagree? And that's going to be very exciting, going to be taking place at Conway Hall in London. It's a sort of joint thing between the British Humanist Association and us here at Premier Christian Radio. Nick Ross will be chairing that panel discussion. Doors open at 7, event starts at 7:30. Other people on the panel, Andrew Copson from the BHA, he's the chief executive. Funnily enough, we went to the same college in the same year at Oxford. Chinny MacDonald, Evangelical Alliance's Director of Communications, will be joining me on the Christian side, and Pavan Dalawal from the BHA will be also with Andrew. So it should be an interesting, I'm sure, very fruitful civil dialogue that day. £6 if you want to go along, and event details available from the Eventbrite website. Search for Can We Agree to Disagree? Christians and Humanists in Dialogue. I know, in fact, that the informal gathering that is the Unbelievable Skeptics and Christians Discussion Group, which meets once a month in London, is actually rescheduling its meeting to actually go to that event and for that to be the basis of what they discuss. So that should be fun. And if you'd like to join them and others who will be going along, as I say, do make sure to register for that event. It should be very interesting indeed. And we're going to be recording it for putting out on Unbelievable soon after. Now, speaking of events, the dialogue you just heard on Hell was actually recorded about a week ago. And since then, I was able to go to the Rethinking Hell conference last weekend. And what a lovely occasion it was. Obviously, a somber sort of topic to be discussing and discussing at some level and a high academic level. But nonetheless, great to meet lots of people there, people who had come via Ichthus Church, especially Roger Forster, one of the key speakers. And so a number of members of Ichthus Church in London were there. But also there were some great speakers flying in from the Netherlands and America. And yeah, it was great to meet plenty of Unbelievable listeners who turned up for the day as well. I enjoyed hearing some excellent speakers. David Instone Brewer, very interesting on not just the biblical references to hell and final destruction, but also looking at some of the extra-biblical literature contemporaneously on that. And well done to Chris Date and John Tancock for putting it all together and putting on a great day. I was able to simply rock up and introduce people and chair the panel discussion and that kind of thing. One person in particular who I got a chance to sit down with, an Unbelievable listener, was Stephen, who told me about his, well, crisis of faith, really, having grown up in church and been a Christian. He sort of very much fell away from it in terms of intellectually thinking it wasn't credible. But very nice to hear that Unbelievable has been part of his journey to coming back to faith. And he's a scientist in Nottingham. We had an interesting conversation about the multiverse episodes that we've had recently on the programme. But lots of other people getting in touch. So let me read out some of what you've been saying in response to recent programmes. This from J.D. Walters, who's got a suggestion. I've recently been reading Mike McCarg's, a.k.a. Science Mike's, new book, Finding God in the Waves. Definitely think it would be a good idea to have him on because, in addition to being a memoir, it's also a proposal for how to approach the issue of science and faith in dialogue with doubters and sceptics. It has some good points, but it also has some flaws, I think. If you're planning to do a show on it and don't have anyone lined up, I wonder if you consider me for the task. I don't have a famous blog and haven't written a book, but I've done a lot of work on the relationship between religion and science and did my undergraduate thesis on the subject. I'm a Christian who grew up in a weird end time cult and had a crisis of faith in college when I was exposed to biblical criticism, other religions, as well as the scientific challenges to faith. I slowly worked my way back to a more mainstream, authentic, robust faith formed in dialogue with greats like Thomas Aquinas and C.S. Lewis. So I speak as someone who can definitely relate to Mike Harg's experience and who can evaluate his proposal in terms of whether and to what extent it's helpful to doubters. Thank you very much, JD. I'm looking to try and get Mike McCarg on the programme. I've had a copy of his book sent to me, and he's got a fascinating story, obviously, himself of abandoning his faith, becoming an atheist, and then his journey back as a scientist. So we will see if we can set something up. I don't know whether it would be with you, JD. Obviously, we'll have to see what works best. But who knows? Thank you for offering yourself. And you don't have to have a famous blog or have written a book in order to come on Unbelievable. There's plenty of people who are just, interested, but intelligent people, I'm sure, like yourself, JD, who do a great job. Last week, great programme. I really enjoyed hosting the discussion between Tom Holland, who's a popular historian about ancient empires and so on here in the UK, and Larry Hurtado, who's a historian of early Christianity. They had a really chummy discussion on the nature of early Christianity, its uniqueness in its pagan setting and so on, and why Tom Holland wrote that article for the New Statesman on why he's changed his mind about the value of Christian history in shaping our Western democracy and ethics. Well, Helen, who is a regular contributor on the Facebook group, says, Justin, are you aware of an event going on at Blackfriars in Oxford on 24th of October between 2 to 3:30? It's called Persons and Human Value, A Few Pagans and Church Fathers. It's a paper presented by John Rist, who has many titles to his name. He was 3 years Regius Professor of Classics at the University of Aberdeen, most recently the holder of the Curl Pritzel Chair in the School of Philosophy in the Catholic University of America, author of 16 books, and so on. But his paper will be attempting to outline the early formation of the concept of a person, this being part of a larger project to account for the construction and degradation of that concept. In passing, it will be suggested that the concept of persons as possessors of value is unintelligible outside a theistic context. So that's an event going on, as I say, at Blackfriars in Oxford, 64 St Giles Street, on the 24th of October. If anyone's interested in pursuing that kind of a theme that was obviously developed in the programme. Lots of love for that programme. People on Facebook and Twitter saying how much they enjoyed the interaction. Johnny Rose, for instance, tweeted me saying, listening to Tom Holland's episode on Unbelievable, I almost feel convinced about starting to read history for pleasure. So who knows? It may affect a change in your reading habits. But others, some of the atheist contributors to the commentary section and by email got in touch about when we touched on slavery on the subject. Francis Janusz on the Facebook page had something to say about that, though I'm going to read, because it's somewhat similar, this email sent in by David Johnson on the issue. He's also a regular contributor on the comment section. He says, I know that you don't like acknowledging me on the board, Justin, but I very much hope we can find common cause this week. I'm sorry if you've picked up some idea that I don't like acknowledging you on the board, David. I think I mentioned you once or twice, but apologies if you didn't feel that was often enough. In the latest programme, the conversation took a turn for the weird, highlighting slavery not once but twice. I tried to dismiss it as tangential, but it ultimately became the elephant in the room. When two scholars seem to be saying praiseworthy things about slavery and the moderator makes no challenge, I feel as though I've taken a detour down the rabbit hole with no way out. I'm not asking you to clarify your guest's position, but your own. I believe I'm not alone in this matter. I need to hear you say that you do not support slavery of any kind, for any reason, of any people, at any time, even if it seems to have been ordered by God. I need you to make it clear that there's no such thing as good slavery. This is mostly a problem for conservative Christians who feel they must defend the God of their Bible at any cost. If the Bible said it and God ordered it, then it must be good at some level for some people in some circumstances at some time. They propose a sort of good slavery. That would be the kind without whips and chains and beatings to within an inch of your life. Well, except the Bible actually defends beating a slave to death as long as it takes him or her more than a couple of days to die from the injuries. Red herrings like indentured servitude are fished out of the murky waters of slavery rehabilitation. God actually improved that wretched institute in the Hebrew scriptures, and the Christians actually elevated slaves in dignity. In other words, the Bible promotes the good slavery. As a descendant of slaves in the American South, I am offended every time someone tries to rehabilitate slavery in the Bible as though it were a good thing. The best slavery you can imagine is still something you would never sell your daughter into. When your guests unnecessarily went in this direction to make their case, I was baffled. When you gave it tacit approval, it left a putrid stench on the programme that lingers. You can do much to clear it up by clearing up your position. I also feel like an apology is in order for leaving the matter ambiguous. The issue should never have come up, and once brought up, it should never have been allowed to stand unchallenged. You believe so strongly in the moral argument, but your argument has no teeth if there can be moral ambiguity about slavery. I do not believe in your moral argument, but I have never thought slavery was a good idea. People are not commodities to be traded, bought, or sold, not for any reason, at any time, by anyone, for any purpose. There is no good slavery. Please clearly state the position of Unbelievable on this matter. Thank you, David. Well, okay, yeah, I don't believe in slavery. I think it's wrong. And my view is, yes, that God is against the buying and selling of people, and that's a universally applicable objective moral principle. And I've got to say, I think if you feel that way, and from everything you've said in your email there, David, you seem to see it as an absolutely universally applicable objective moral principle. I really struggle to see how, as an atheist, you can ground that, because, you know, without an objective realm to appeal to, it surely is just a case of cultural things change, and morality is completely subjective. But anyway, but obviously you're asking me this. I mean, when it comes to scriptures, and you've talked about what appears to be in Exodus 21, the rules about how you can treat slaves and so on, I think you've really got to read that in context. Exodus 21, as far as I can see, is all about the Jewish people being asked to stand apart from their pagan counterparts when it comes to the issue of slavery. And so it's, if you like, it's moving the conversation on, the morality on, from where they were. Now, when it comes to the Old Testament, I think what you're dealing with is Yahweh's dealings with an often recalcitrant and stubborn people. So, and he's kind of leading them slowly towards a better understanding. So, yes, I do believe that God, if you like, for certain purposes, allowed that institution to continue, because there was no better way in some ways of the trajectory. You know, it was a trajectory in scripture. I think you see that trajectory carried on in the New Testament towards emancipation. I don't think that negates that there is an objective moral fact about the matter. It's just that within the context of history, God may choose to act in certain ways that eventually lead to the right outcome. So I've never seen that as being a major kind of issue. And I guess that was kind of the view that Tom Holland and Larry Hurtado were also putting forward on the thing. But as I say, I still really struggle to see how an atheist like yourself could make that objective moral stand on slavery. Absolutely, which is the right stand. We can all agree on that. But I think the real problem is for the atheist justifying that moral stance in light of the fact there is no moral realm within which these duties and values can really exist. So for me, I guess the fact is that, yeah, God deals with people in ways that are culturally appropriate for where they are. That doesn't negate that there is a real moral issue at stake as well. I'm sure you disagree. I'm sure I haven't in any way adequately for you answered the issue at hand, David, or indeed for Francis. But that's where I come down on it. I don't see a major conflict there between those two things. Thank you for getting in touch. So let's just squeeze this one in. This was from Brian D. Rakus, who's a Christian doctor who actually emailed me after the Derren Brown interview took place here on Unbelievable. Derren Brown, of course, a skeptical illusionist, massively famous here in the UK for his stage shows and TV programmes. And if you happen to see it, in fact, the Miracle Stage Show, which was the topic of much of our conversation back in the summer, actually aired on Channel 4 here in the UK this last week. So it was very much in the public eye and lots of stories going around on social media and the press about that. But you wanted to take up the challenge that Derren Brown laid down for objective evidence for physical miracles. And we turned your email, Brian, into a blog for the magazine. I thought it was a really interesting viewpoint. So I'm going to actually read that out in its entirety here and see what people have to say in response to it. So here it goes. In last month's Premier Christianity magazine, Derren Brown explained how he was sceptical regarding miraculous claims. Following the broadcast of that interview on Unbelievable, a listener challenged Christian physicians to come forward with miracle stories and objective evidence of them. Well, challenge accepted. I am a physician and have been treating patients for 23 years. Brown said he would want to verify a miracle healing with objective evidence, such as vastly different x-rays. I've seen a number of cases that could be considered miraculous based on this criteria, where patients have behaved in ways completely inexplicable with their current medical knowledge. Just this past month, I met a middle-aged healthy lady who presented with symptoms of sudden onset of heart failure. An echocardiogram of her heart confirmed this. This finding usually prompts a left heart catheterization to further evaluate the cause. This was done the following day, and to everyone's astonishment, the heart function was completely normal. Puzzled, a repeat echocardiogram was performed the same day and was completely normal. We initially thought there must be some mistake, the wrong patient, someone else's test, or some other explanation, and everything was re-examined, and the results were verified by multiple cardiologists. The collective 100 years of medical experience of the team of physicians involved had never heard or seen this. It's absolutely unexplainable in medical terms, not thought to be possible. This is an example of an objective, carefully measured, verifiable set of advanced imaging studies showing a complete healing of severe heart failure, all in less than 24 hours. Here's another story. I regularly visit third world countries as part of medical relief teams. I was once in remote Mexico with a team treating very poor people as best we could. We had a very experienced otolaryngologist, I think that's how you pronounce it, with us, and he was evaluating children for cleft lip and cleft palate repair. A young child was brought to him, and upon inspecting his nasal cavity, he discovered an obstructing tumour called nasopharyngeal cancer. These are universally fatal if not treated aggressively, and with the physician's vast experience, he was certain this was the diagnosis even without a biopsy. The parents were instructed to bring the child back the next day for surgery. A group of people prayed with the family. The following morning, they showed up with the child. Preoperative checklists were done, and just before the child underwent anaesthesia, the surgeon took one last look. There was no tumour. They summoned the parents and told them they'd brought the wrong child, but they insisted it was the same one. There was a great deal of conversation among our team, translators, and the family, but in the end, we all bore witness that this was the same child. There was no rational or medical explanation for this. These tumours simply do not disappear overnight. These are the facts, and different people can come to various conclusions about how to explain them. I give these examples not to say someone like Derren Brown, here is a miracle, it proves there is a God and you cannot refute it. I share them because they fit the demand of objective proof of something considered miraculous that's often put forth. I'm a skeptic by nature, and with my rigorous medical training, everything must be proven. I'm not saying these two instances are miracles in the sense that I absolutely believe that God directly intervened in space and time and deliberately did something to alter the course of nature. By nature, I tend not to believe this actually happens very often. It's possible the text tests got mixed up or were performed in error, or they brought the wrong boy, or we were victims of a hoax. We clearly do not have complete medical knowledge. There are always outliers. Maybe there are 1 in 1 million people who have the genetic capacity to regrow a limb instantly, or have a widespread cancer disappear, or have some other condition completely reverse or heal in an unthinkably short period of time. In that case, the regrowing of a limb before one's eyes would not be a divine miracle, just an ultra-rare natural occurrence. This explanation prevents a challenge, not just to the believer, but to the non-believer. If the rare but naturally possible explanation can apply to the above medical stories, then surely it can also apply to the resurrection of Jesus. Could a skeptic admit the resurrection of Jesus really did happen, and that 1 in 1 billion people have the genetic or physical capability to defy death and have the cells and organs of their body restart after a couple of days? Given that there are clear instances of apparent healings, many Christians have wondered why such stories don't make the front page of our scientific journals, not to mention the national newspapers. We as doctors do not jump to miracle explanations. It's not within the scope of medicine to speculate on such things, and no legitimate journal is going to publish something as such. That said, there are case reports throughout the medical literature of all kinds of things, including the unexplainable. In fact, most are published for that reason, that they are outside the norm of what is known or expected. Most experienced physicians can tell stories of the unexplained and seemingly miraculous, some well documented. I think the nature of belief itself in an individual person predicts how they'll ultimately perceive a set of facts, rather than the facts themselves. With regards to purported miracles, defined here as an intervention by a supernatural agent to alter an otherwise natural course of events, it seems that both the believer and the denier deal with a probability. If one of the medical examples I gave were perceived as a miracle by a believer, there's an onus on that person to have a threshold of what they consider a miracle versus chance. For instance, I've heard of a person who prays for mundane things such as a parking spot at the shopping mall. When she does get a great one after praying, maybe she attributes it to God's intervention. Well, most of us would ascribe it to chance. The probability did not exceed our limit for what would be miraculous. What then is our limit or criteria? The believer must admit at least a chance that what happened was a natural event, even when statistically improbable. Given the billions of people who have ever lived, is it so improbable that just one could rise from the dead as simply a natural anomaly? Similarly, it seems to me that the onus is upon the miracle denier to have some probability threshold that must be eclipsed to be considered a miracle. What proof is enough? What evidence is required? Is it not at least possible that a creator could periodically intervene in its creation? Let's postulate that a respected medical journal article published a patient case replete with hard and concrete documentation of an extraordinary healing or recovery that seemed impossible and unexplainable by any medical knowledge, and it was reviewed by 1,000 independent physicians, and all 1,000 agreed that it was a miracle. Is that enough? What about 10,000 doctors? If not, then how many? What statistical power does one require to prove or disprove it as a miracle? I find this relation between probability and belief crucial for many topics beyond this, as it seems the basic dividing line, by definition, is belief between the theist and atheist. And you finally, you say in this email, which we've turned into a blog, Brian, different individuals will look at it, the same event or data, through a different worldview lens and come to polar opposite conclusions. But there's an entirely different level of miracle that often gets overlooked. This miracle can be found simply by observing normal processes in the body that go on unconsciously every second of every day without much celebration or appreciation. Take any organ system in the body, read how it works and how multiple systems work together and how a single enzyme can convert millions of molecules per second. This is not even to mention the miracle of consciousness from unconsciousness, or as Einstein put it, the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is comprehensible. If someone looks past all of this without a sense of a miracle, I've very little confidence a limb regrowing before their eyes would ever constitute one. There you go. Brian D. Rikus, living in the Midwest USA. He's been a practicing physician of internal medicine since 1997. Wonder what you thought about that. There's certainly a few comments underneath that on our blog. If you want to read it for yourself, do go to premierchristianity.com/blog and leave your thoughts there. And yes, Brian said he will try to get hold of some medical notes to back up that story that he starts that blog out with about the lady with the heart condition that disappeared overnight. So thanks for listening to today's programme. Always aim to get you thinking. Hope this programme has as well, including our feedback section. Time to sign off now and tell you what's coming up at the same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
Yes, time to grab the bull by the horns and talk about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, of course. We're going to ask, should Christians back Donald Trump? Of course, this is a question primarily for US listeners of this program, but everyone around the world is watching this most divisive of contests from across the pond. And yes, it's split evangelical Christians, certainly, some of whom are backing and some of whom couldn't imagine backing Donald Trump. Wonder what you think? Well, we'll be hearing from my two guests, Christina Reese and John Smirak, same time next week. Hope you can join me for that. Until then, have a great week.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.